Tech Talk. Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Harvey Norman. Computers, cameras, tablets, phones, drones, smartwatches. We have it all. Harvey Norman are the technology specialists.
This is News Talk. Tech Talk. With Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Harvey Norman. Computers, cameras, tablets, phones, drones, smartwatches. We have it all. Harvey Norman are the technology specialists.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Tech Talk. Coming up this week, I meet the team behind GoFundMe, the crowdraising platform that gives back. We'll hear how it works and meet the man leading the collection for Sean Cox. We'll ask, should we go back to the drawing board in terms of the national broadband plan and learn more about bike sharing plans for Dublin City. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or tweet with #TechTalkNT. Now, broadband has been back in the news all this week. We had announcements from Air and Imagine, and then representatives from the key telcos in Ireland appeared before the Public Accounts Committee on Thursday. The focus was the National Broadband Plan, but are we at the point of scrappage now? Should we move on, and what is the best approach? I'm joined now by David Russell, the CEO of Host Ireland. David, you're very welcome to the show. Firstly, what is Host Ireland?
So we are a fixed wireless broadband provider based here in the Dublin market, in the Greater Dublin, with an all-Ireland coverage. We use a fixed wireless solution to deliver up to 2 gigabit per second connectivity. We operate only in the business-to-business sector.
Okay, so broadband is a topic that's, you know, been very, very important to people, particularly those living outside the big cities for the last number of years as we continue to wait for the National Broadband Plan. We know that the telcos were in front of the PAC on Thursday talking about why they stepped away from the National Broadband Plan. But what I want to talk to you about is the fact that we saw Air hosting an event on Monday morning at 8 o'clock telling us about their $500 million investment in their network. And then on Wednesday of this week, Imagine hosted an event where they told us about their plans. So between Air, Imagine and other people around the country, do we still need the National Broadband Plan?
So I think we do need... The likes of Imagine and Air, the first thing is private industry is filling the void that government's leaving. Mm. And we've always said and always thought that would be the case, particularly since the National Broadband Plan was launched in 2012. We've taken 7 years to get to this point, so private industry has realised that there's a hole that needs to be filled. But I think there is a need for the National Broadband Plan because private industry is there to do one thing, and that's make money. So private industry will ensure there's connectivity to the areas of population. So areas of population where they're going to get connectivity and make money on it. It's as simple as that. We have a number of rural communities, areas in the island that still need connectivity that may not be as lucrative or as appealing to commercial organisations. So they need connectivity, and that's the National Broadband Plan can fill the void.
And so, but to that end, if it's that simple, if it is the areas where intervention is needed, and it is called the intervention area, if you look at my favourite map in the world is the map that's on broadband.gov.ie, and when you go onto that, you can see the entire country looks amber, which is the colour that identifies the space that needs state intervention. What I've seen this week is that the operators are saying, well, we're going to go and we're going to try and swoop in there and, you know, fill in some of the blanks and try and bring people up to some form of decent speed. So did we really, really, really need to spend the amount of money that we spent on the NBP to date? And is this not something that the commercial operators would have just done naturally anyway? Is the NBP pressure just making them speed up? Because it's in their interest to hoover up as many people as possible so that they can get them as clients and make the money.
So yes and no. So yes, it is in the interest of the businesses to hoover the businesses, the homes, the organisations as quickly as possible. The National Broadband Plan, that whole amber area, we've always said that the only solution to this is a fixed wireless hybrid with fibre solution. So what we mean by that is, yes, fibre has a role to play in connecting the island of Ireland, but so has fixed wireless. It's much cheaper, it's much quicker, And multiple countries, the UK, the US, Australia being just some examples, have used this hybrid solution to get their communities, and particularly their rural communities, connected as quickly as possible. So no, we didn't need to spend the amount of money we've spent to date. When the National Broadband Plan was launched in 2012, arguably fixed wireless technology wasn't worth that today. But now there's evidence to show fixed wireless connectivity and solutions technology actually is better than fibre. So a hybrid solution would allow our communities, the rural businesses, government organisations and so forth, be connected up much, much quicker. What we have at the minute is we have still no clarity on the National Broadband Plan. Mm. We still don't know when it's going to be rolled out. We don't know who the provider is. We've seen today in the press, there's a number of articles around the only bidder left, the ENET Consortium. So there's so much uncertainty that the government has to act now. And you rightly say around the cost piece, the longer this takes, the more costly it's going to get. Also comes in the future-proof piece. So 2012, this whole plan was rolled out. Mm-hmm. 30 meg, what Pat Rabbit, the minister at the time, spoke about. We've outgrown 30 meg.
By a long shot.
When you look at what homes require, so you as a consumer have smart home, connected devices, even Netflix, even your Sunday evening at home relaxing after your show, watching Netflix, you want to be connected and you want to ensure that your upload-download speeds are symmetrical, that you can download your favourite show, that you're sending the relevant data as quickly as possible, whatever that might be around your connected home. So that's kind of where we need this quickly. And the longer we take, the more expensive it's going to be for the country.
And so you've hit on a few different points there that I want to come back to. So in relation to the timeline of the NBP, Carolan Lennon of AIR on Monday morning said that she believed the NBP will take 5 to 7 years to be completed. That is bonkers.
So that could be generous. Caroline could be generous in that. Because when you think about it, so it's over 100,000 kilometres of fibre. It's 540,000 users. It's effectively the electrification of Ireland. The National Broadband Plan looks at one technology and one technology only, fibre, which is costly both in time and money to roll out.
Yeah, and people don't understand and appreciate the practical side, because you think, just lay the bleeding cable, like let it run by my door and grand. You have to go out and do a recce. You have to go and see, are there trees that need to be dug up? Does road closures need to happen? Do we need to get traffic management or the Gardaí or whatever? Then do we bring in the equipment to dig it? Then there are so many different levels, and I wasn't fully aware of this until I fully became immersed in the whole process. I've spoken to people in AIR and to other providers. There's a colossal amount of work that goes into bringing fibre to the cabinet, regardless, like forget about the home or anything like that.
There's an incredible, and the variables will differ. Ireland's geography, Ireland's townlands, cities are all very different.
Mm.
You have different county councils, you have the guard, you have access to roads, you rightly say trees, whatever may happen. Some of that fibre will be in the ground, some will be in telegraph poles. So there's so many different variables you have to contend with. So the idea that you can connect 540,000 plus businesses, roll out over 100,000 kilometres of fibre across this island in even, as you know, Caroline's outlined, 5 to 7 years, but even in that time frame, it's crazy to think that could be done. And that's kind of why we keep coming back to this hybrid fixed wireless.
So explain to me what exactly that is, and in terms of practicality, what does that look like? Because again, you know, towards the end of last year, I was doing a lot on the Hard Shoulder and the Pat Kenny Show, distinguishing the difference in the language used in terms of homes passed and homes connected in relation to open air and their rollout. There is a big distinction there. But what does this hybrid solution offer, and how does it work, and how do I get, because this is all people want to know about, is how can I get decent broadband to my home regardless of where I am?
So the hybrid solution uses wireless. So it's effectively a little antenna or a little radio, in very simple terms, that's connected to the user's home or business or property. That is then directed towards a base station that is located somewhere close by. That base station is then fed using fibre to allow that user to get connected to the internet.
Okay, so the fibre is delivered from from an exchange to a
Correct.
Base station, and then it's beamed from the base station to my little adapter. Okay.
Absolutely. And the technology that's used, so there was once upon a time that fixed wireless wasn't getting the bandwidth required. You know, you were talking, you know, 5 meg and talking very low speeds. Fixed wireless is now proven to deliver speeds up to 2 gig. Now, there's a number of variables around proximity to base stations, equipment used and license required, but it shows that you can get that level of connectivity very, very quickly. So particularly on unlicensed frequencies, which is potentially one option, you could be up running tomorrow. If the fibre is there and the base station is built, and some many of our towns and villages already have some sort of fibre that they could use. But if it's there, the actual last mile part, the connecting the customer up, that is so cheap, so quick, and can happen the very next day. I mean, for us in Host Ireland, because we have the topology in Dublin, we can get customers up and running the same day. That's how quickly this can be rolled out.
But is this one of the solutions? Because again, you know, over the last few years when I've been doing these reports, I've gone out to meet people around the country who say, oh, well, there's satellite broadband in my area, but when the trees are in bloom, the signal drops out. Or if my wife is downstairs on her iPad and I'm upstairs, you know, trying to stream Netflix, the whole place just wets the bed and it can't work.
So you have two different technologies.
Yeah.
You have satellite technology, which requires satellites in effect, and the latency, and what I mean by that is the speed. So the bandwidth is how much capacity you're getting, the latency is how quickly. So if you're wanting to stream, latency is quite important. So if you think about it in simple terms, you're in your home, you're sending the signal to the satellite, the satellite to send it back. You have high levels of latency. What we're talking about is fixed wireless connectivity. So it's exactly the same what happens in fiber in the ground, but it's done in the air. And the technology has evolved that, yes, there was a time, particularly in some of the rural communities, when wireless was first thought about and rolled out to some areas, that you were getting 3 or 4 meg. So yes, if two people were watching Netflix, the whole thing crashed.
Yeah.
That is not where the technology is now. The technology can achieve speeds greater, much greater than the 30 meg that the minister in this instance, when the National Broadband Plan spoke about in 2012 around fiber, you can certainly get better than that. So you can run a modern home with multiple devices connected on fixed wireless. In terms of the trees, or the trees are in bloom, that, you know, that's around ensuring that the equipment can see the base station clearly. It's about building the base stations in the right places. But that's all very simple stuff that can got over very quickly, particularly if there is a interest and a drive both by government and private industry to build a proper fixed wireless network on this island. Those sort of problems can go away very, very quickly.
But will there still be homes where fixed, like, so I just want to know, right? Say if we went and we split the houses that are covered by the MBP into little piles. Mm-hmm. And if we said, okay, well, X amount could be serviced by a fixed wireless solution, there would still be a second pile that would need fibre to the home because they would be too far from a base station. Is that correct?
No, well, it's actually the reverse. So there is areas on the island, particularly some of the towns and cities, that you can run fibre into. And that can be your area to take your base station from the last mile to rural communities. So connect those guys up with fibre. Happy days, no problem at all. It's actually the rural communities. It's actually those who are too far away from the towns and cities can actually benefit from fixed wireless. The distances that can be covered can be quite lengthy. So if you're out in rural West Cork, for example, and you can run fibre to Skibbereen, you can use that base station either through one or two hops, but you can actually connect those rural homes up to fixed wireless and give them broadband opportunities that they never thought was possible. You contrast that to the National Broadband Plan. You bring the fibre into Skibbereen. You then need to bring that fibre from, say, Skibbereen, to some of the towns and villages where one house, we have a beautiful countryside, but often we have one house in the hillside.
In the back end, yeah.
That house has to be connected up. Think about the logistics. Mm. Running up the road, digging the road up, under a hedge, up a telegraph pole, into the house and so forth. That's one home. We have 540,000 homes in this island, our businesses and properties to do.
Mm. So how recent is the, like, at what stage did the fixed wireless solution become viable enough that we should, or the government should be looking at this as a serious contender for solving the broadband problem? Stepping away from the NBP for a second, because I think we're so fixated on that process. And I understand that it has to be up for tender and I understand the legality around all of that. But again, if I'm living in an area where I don't have broadband, I don't care about processes. I want to be able to run my business from wherever I want to in the country. It would take massive pressure off the housing crisis, the office crisis, all of that kind of stuff, if we could find a solution.
No, absolutely. And I think just to add to that, as workforces and workplaces change, there will be more working from home. So there will be more of a pressure on employers and in terms of the infrastructure.
Yeah.
People want to work at home because of flexibility and the way work-life balance has changed. Fixed wireless really started to come into its own probably about 4 or 5 years ago.
Wow, okay.
There was, you know, arguably before that, it could achieve low speeds, particularly in the country. Mm-hmm. Dublin's slightly different. But that technology has evolved massively. We as a company went to the wireless convention in the US in October to see what was happening in the US. And we were speaking to some of the providers there who were talking about developing equipment capable of 25 gigs and 100 gigs per second. This is just astronomical bandwidths that would never, and certainly not in the short to medium term, be needed in this island. But it shows where wireless has really jumped to. It shows what can be achieved from wireless. So certainly in this last 4 to 5 years, wireless has definitely come into its own. And you can see that in Dublin. You can see a significant amount of the blue chip companies now having a wireless only solution. But the vast majority of businesses, certainly from high level SME up to the larger organisations, blue chips and international companies, have potentially fibre as a primary, but they will have wireless as a backup. Because the other thing about, you know, if you look at from the city landscape, a lot of these large organisations need to ensure that they have continuous connectivity.
Well, this is what I was going to say. So I have my smart TV plugged in. I have a LAN cable going in the back because I could run it off the Wi-Fi network, but I don't want my Netflix buffering. I know it's a first world problem, but it's still a problem. So I have that wired solution there.
Yeah.
How reliable and consistent will the fixed wireless solution be as we continue to, you know, bring more devices into the home, or, you know, if there's a storm and one of the masts get knocked down or something like that? I mean, how realistic is it that we would have a significant portion of the country running off a fixed wireless solution?
So if you look at other countries have a significant portion, Australia particularly. And in fact, thankfully, we're not like this, but Australia even has some fixed wireless base stations that can only be reached by helicopter. Thankfully, we're never going to be in that problem. But the technology and the quality of the connection are good enough now that you will not have that issue.
Mm.
Some of the issues you talk about there, the wireless piece, so that's more to do with your internal wireless router, and there's solutions around that, mesh networks and so forth. What we're talking about is kind of behind that again.
Mm-hmm.
It's the connection into the home. It's the box you're plugging your LAN cable into. So at the minute, assuming you live in Dublin, for example, you're probably on some sort of fibre or contented service. So what we're talking about is exactly the same. So the box will look the same, but how the connection, how the data is transferred to and from the home is in the air and not on the ground.
Okay, so bottom line, MVP, we're still waiting on. If they decide not to go with Granaghan McCourt, and if we have to go through this entire process again, is it most practical in terms of getting people connected as soon as possible to consider the hybrid solution that you have mentioned there? So fixed wireless alongside an element of fibre?
I think it's the only solution. I think the idea of rolling out fibre to the island of Ireland or to the south of Ireland is just crazy at this point. We have waited 7 years. Businesses, communities, organisations and government have waited 7 years outside of, particularly outside of Dublin. People can wait no longer. So as Caroline outlined, 5 to 7 years, that could be generous. It could be longer than that. A fixed wireless solution can be much, much quicker. And just to take it to the next level, one of the other solutions I've used in other jurisdictions is a subsidy model. So the government supports the multitude of private wireless and fibre companies that are out there to the subsidy model. Choose whatever provider you want. Use a subsidy. You subsidise the home. You subsidise the business. They get another provider in. Because the other question that the National Broadband Plan raises is who's going to own the network?
Well, this is a massive one. Like, it is just huge. We're already seeing the rowing over the infrastructure that we have. Who owns what? How much do I have to pay the people who own it to get it taken from, you know, the crossroads up to my home? It's a huge problem.
It's a huge problem. And technology is constantly evolving. You know, you think back to your mobile phone, think to your first iPhone, to what your current iPhone can do now. So technology does evolve. So if you have a model that's funded by the government, there's uncertainty who owns the network and so forth, then you have challenges around who's going to future-proof that? Who's going to continuously invest that? Are we looking at a scenario? Let's imagine in a perfect world, the National Broadband Plan was signed off and we have fibre to the home tomorrow. Everybody's connected. Happy days. In 5 years' time, when that technology could be out of date, who's going to upgrade that? Are we going to go back to an attending process? Are the government going to have to put their hands back in their pocket to do that? If you go to the subsidy model we're talking about, you know, taking the discussion, you know, from hybrid fixed wireless, then how do we properly roll that out? It puts the onus on private enterprise. Let free market reign, because that will create a competitive environment. Everybody will want that customer. You know, back to your earlier point around is it time to let private enterprise take those businesses, fill those holes and fill those gaps? So you subsidise that. You get users, consumers going to whoever they want. Those companies will want to hold on to those customers, so they will continually invest in their network. And if they don't, customer can move to somebody who will.
Yeah.
So you allow the island of Ireland, in terms of its connectivity needs, to be continuously evolving, getting better, future-proofing itself. Because what you don't want to have is not a broadband plan rolled out, even if someone was to, the minister was to wave a magic wand over it and we got it rolled out at lightning speed. What we don't want to do is have to revisit this problem. It took us 7 years. Will it take us another 7 years to future-proof it again?
Oh, please, let's say no. Please, please, please. Thank you so much for your time. I really want to hear from people around the country. What is your broadband scenario? How long have you been waiting? Are you one of those businesses that has to drive to the car park of a Starbucks to pay your staff? We've heard that story many times. The email address is techtalk@newstalk.com. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
That was David Russell of Host Ireland. Coming up next, GoFundMe.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. You can email us now, techtalk@newstalk.com. On Wednesday this week, I popped down to Mount Street in Dublin 2 to meet the European team behind GoFundMe.
I'm Nicole Schneegas and I'm the European Customer Operations Manager here in Dublin. So GoFundMe really is all about helping people to help other people. And the way we kind of put it is GoFundMe is the take action button off the internet. You know, basically, if you want to put up a picture on the internet, you go to Instagram. You want to put up a status, you go to Facebook. And if you want to take action on something, you go to GoFundMe. So if you see someone who needs a bit of help, or you see something in your community that needs to be done, or maybe you're in help, you know, in need of help for something, kind of GoFundMe is the place where you go to share your story and then look for financial support from your community, from your network. To give you an example of that, the kind of biggest category we see at the moment is medical causes. So we see like thousands of people who are able to get the financial support they need for medical treatment or seeking treatment abroad a lot of the time. A really touching example that we had here in Ireland specifically is the Sean Cox campaign, where the community were able to get together and rally behind the cause and raise over €800,000, which is incredible when you kind of think about what you know people can do when they get together, and it just kind of really restores your faith in humanity. And they're the kind of you know things we see on GoFundMe a lot. They're kind of the big ones, but of course it's also about the kind of smaller everyday type of campaigns that people set up. Another example that I like is the you know something that happened in the Cabra community. There was a few people that got together to form the Cabra Tidy Towns, and they just set up a GoFundMe campaign to kind of cover their insurance costs. They raised, you know, it was like €300, I think, over a couple of days. And, you know, they're the kind of things. So it could be like something really small where people just need financial support to kind of take action on something in their community, or it could be something like major and really life-changing for somebody.
What I like about it is because it's internet-based, you know, when I was in school, we used to get these sponsorship forms, and it's like, you know, Jessica will do her homework by 4 o'clock every day and just sponsor her to be great and do that. Yeah. And you get €2 from like your family and your siblings, and that's it. Yeah. This is the same idea, but, you know, you can fight for a local cause on an international platform by just having the one link. It's a very neat way of doing it, I suppose. Talk to me about the business behind GoFundMe. So where is the company from? What is this base that we're in now, and how many people are working for it?
So GoFundMe was all started by two guys called Brad and Andy back in San Diego. And it was in 2010 that they actually launched GoFundMe, the platform itself. Before that they tried a few other kind of things and played around with a few other business models. But really what their idea was to create an easy way for people to, you know, support each other financially. And, you know, there was an original idea as well to exchange services too. But yeah, that's kind of where the idea of that platform grew. And so, yeah, as I said, they launched in 2010. And from there, it kind of, especially in the US, it just kind of was a word by mouth situation. And it just kind of snowballed from there. And it grew very, very much organically over the years. And obviously it's very well-known platform in the States. You know, everybody has kind of started a GoFundMe at some point in their lives or used it. So then we kind of now trying to grow more internationally, specifically in the European countries. And that's where we set up the Dublin office, you know, to kind of be here and be able to provide that kind of support to our customers in Europe specifically, and providing the support in their native languages too. So that's why we have so many multilingual people working in the office.
And you said about 17 people working here, is that right?
Yeah, it's a really small and cozy office. There's only 17 of us looking after the customer happiness and also the trust and safety internationally. So yeah, it's a really fun and caring group of people, all coming from different backgrounds, different cultures, speaking different languages. And really it's just a group of people who just really care about helping others.
You mentioned trust and safety there. That is something that's very important when you are, like anything to do with money, trust and safety is important. But when you're doing these fundraisers, and I don't want to be a cynic, but I am, you know, how do you guys ensure that if someone is putting up a picture of, you know, a limp puppy or whatever it is and saying, you know, go fund them or whatever, how do you verify that it's a true cause and not a money-making scam?
Trust is like probably the most important thing for us, and it's paramount. And of course, you know, from the donor to the campaign organizer, you know, for us it's just incredibly important that people trust our site. Otherwise, I guess, you know, GoFundMe just simply wouldn't work. So we have kind of what I like to call like a triangle system in place. You know, we have the technology that kind of is constantly just scanning and looking for anything that looks a bit sketchy and would like flag things to us. And at the same time, we have a really dedicated group of people who are also kind of experts in the like financial sector and coming from a background of banks, who are scanning manually and kind of making checks on a regular basis to make sure that the money is going where it's supposed to go and that everything, you know, looks good. And then we also have the GoFundMe community to rely on, you know, a big group of people who basically will report anything to us that looks in any way sketchy or fraudulent. And, you know, we're obviously, we have that in place 24/7. So we're always just scanning for that and looking out for that. But really, you know, it's always at top of people's minds, obviously, but there's like such a small amount of, like a tiny percentage of, campaigns that are fraudulent, you know, surprisingly. So that's great, I guess, you know, and most people are really genuinely just good.
Yeah, no, they do seem to be. You know, I've seen friends using it for, if they're running the marathon for a charity, but there are also, and you alluded to it earlier, the causes that go viral. So, you know, there are ones that spring to my mind of, you know, sick children or victims of terrorism or a natural disaster. Do you guys get emotionally attached to the causes, and do you follow those stories, or is it just numbers that are appearing on an Excel spreadsheet somewhere?
No, 100%. We definitely get really attached, and it's not rare that you see people in our office crying because they just, you know, get so into the stories, and just, you know, all these stories that we come across every single day are so inspiring or really touching or heartbreaking, and, you know, we really connect with that. And as I mentioned, you know, we are really just a big group of people who love helping others. A lot of us would come from kind of a background of social care work like myself, or community work, have done a lot of volunteer work. So that's kind of actually one of our criteria when we're hiring people. It's like, it needs to be people who care about people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we 100% all get very attached. Yeah, I can't really get away around that, you know. Yeah, and we have a gifts back program in place, actually, where all employees at GoFundMe get to pick their favorite campaigns every week to nominate them for the gifts back program, and GoFundMe will then essentially make a contribution, a donation to that campaign to support the cause, which is great, you know.
So you actually have to care. You have to care enough for that money to go somewhere.
You have to. I mean, you don't have to nominate campaigns, but we always do, because it's just such a great opportunity to, yeah, as the name says, give back. And then if, you know, you come across those kind of campaigns that you're specifically attached to every week, you just nominate it and have a chance to kind of, you know, just make a difference that way.
That's lovely. And so you mentioned we're here in the Dublin office now, you 17 people here, you're looking to take on Europe, I suppose, and make more of a dent. Does that mean that we could see, you know, the team expansion, or what are the ambitions short term and then medium term?
Well, that's obviously, you know, our dream and hope to like expand our office a little bit. Even though it's only 17 people here, to us that already feels huge in comparison to the 4 people that we started out with. So obviously, you know, our growth very much kind of just depends on the growth that we see in the European countries specifically. So of course, our hope is that more and more people across Europe, you know, kind of are able to turn to GoFundMe to like take action or make a difference in other people's lives. So as that happens more and more, then of course, course, we will need to and would want to put the right support in place here to support our international customers.
Okay, so again, just to reiterate the message, if somebody is sitting at home and they're thinking of running a marathon, doing a local fundraiser, whatever it may be, is there a cost for using the platform, or how does that work?
No, really, the platform can be used for any cause. And, you know, of course, when people think of crowdfunding, the first thing that comes to mind is like charity or maybe medical or those kind of like huge kind of life-changing events. But it doesn't have to be that at all. And I would really encourage people to, you know, it's like the perfect platform. If you want to just take action in your community, or there's something small that you've always wanted to do, then, you know, just setting up a campaign, it's so simple and so easy. It can be done in a matter of a few minutes. Our team is here, like from start to finish, to guide you along the process, to, you know, share tips and kind of be there even for emotional support. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I would say, you know, that's the kind of beauty of crowdfunding and a platform like GoFundMe, is that you can just, you know, use it for anything, really, you know, and it doesn't always have to be something tragic or, you know, yeah.
And so is there a transaction fee then as well? Like, how do you guys make money? Because it is a business.
I'm glad you're asking, because at the end of 2017 we started getting rid of our 5% platform fee. So across most countries we now just operate on a tipping model, and what that means is that donors have the opportunity to leave a voluntary contribution, and if they decide to give a voluntary contribution to GoFundMe, they can also decide themselves how much that would be. So it could be as small or as big as you'd like, and really that then allows us to keep the website running, and it allows us to pay our amazing staff as well.
And so as a business then, if you are living off tips, or like, is there advertising, or what way does it work?
No, so we just really solely rely on the tips from the generous donors, and for now, you know, it's obviously we've been operating on that model for just over a year, and it works really well for us so far. And, you know, people, I think, kind of when they use the platform, they generally kind of are really supportive of GoFundMe, the website, because they see what it can do, and they can see the change it makes in people's lives. So they want to support it, and they want to support the staff that are behind it, you know. Yeah.
Gus Lynch.
So Gus, just tell me how you are using GoFundMe.
So we're involved with a campaign for a friend and colleague, Sean Cox, who was at a Liverpool game last year, and he suffered life-changing injuries as a result of an assault that took place. And a group of us have come together, and we have set up a GoFundMe campaign, amongst other campaigns. There are other fundraisers that we're doing on the side, more of which later. But we set up a GoFundMe campaign in order that we could try to raise $2 million in ongoing care fund for Sean's recovery.
And why did you decide to go down the GoFundMe route? Because there are different ways to raise money. There's different ways to get your message out there. And this story in particular caught many people's attention, because it was just incredibly, it's one of those ones where you sit back and you think how and why. But why did you decide to use the GoFundMe page?
Well, there are numerous ways of getting the media attention that you require for a campaign such as this. However, the GoFundMe experience is very simple to set up from a back-end point of view for maintenance and the monitoring of the campaign. But also from the giver's point of view, it's just so simple. You're sitting in your room, you can put €50 into a campaign, it's done, it's, you know, it's 30 seconds, 45 seconds, the job is done, and you know where the money's going. And that's the beauty of the GoFundMe campaign.
And how did you find using this to kind of get the message out to people so that they would put the €50 in, or the €20 or the €2, whatever they can afford? How did you find, you know, getting that message out there so that people did put the hand in the pocket?
Well, we've been very fortunate that people are inherently kind and they want to give to a cause such as Sean's. I think Sean's incident really resonated with a lot of people. Just by its very mundanity, a man going to a game on a April evening, and, you know, something catastrophic occurred, and, you know, he was in a lot of difficulty, and he remains in a lot of difficulty, and his recovery is ongoing. But I think it did capture a certain public imagination I think that people were disposed to looking at it favourably in terms of what they would donate to. We've been very fortunate with media coverage. People have been, you know, exceptionally helpful. Everywhere everyone we speak to always puts the GoFundMe/support Sean Cox at the end of their interview or in the print media or online media. The hashtag support Sean is catchy. Liverpool as a city is a huge football town. Dublin has a huge amount of Liverpool fans. It was just something I think that resonated with a lot of people. And in conjunction with our social media campaigns, you know, some of the press and PR that we've been able to do and the television that some of the guys have been able to do, the story has remained current. And that's critically important in a campaign such as this, when we're trying to raise what is a very significant amount of money. So I think all of this, the sum of the parts has contributed to the whole. And the GoFundMe piece, it's just so easy for people to donate, and it's so easy to promote via social media and through the front end of the GoFundMe platform.
And you mentioned there about the maintenance side of things, because, you know, running something like this, and as you said, keeping it current and keeping it front and center of people's minds, is a huge body of work for any number of people. So having something that is as clean as the GoFundMe back end must have been beneficial, particularly because you can monitor how much is coming in, when it's coming, where it's coming from, and you know it's in a safe space.
Absolutely. I mean, that is probably the greatest benefit of the GoFundMe piece, is that, you know, like you say, when the money is coming in, you see it, it's real time. It comes across the app, or it drops an email to say, look, such and such donated 50 euros, 1,000 euros, 5,000 euros, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. You can see it in real time, and you know where that money is going, and you know that ultimately it's going to go to the right place.
This you mentioned there about the GoFundMe page. It's still active. People can still donate. You know, there are so many different ways or causes that people can get behind. If someone's listening to this now, what would you say to them to try and get that 5 or 50 quid out of them?
Well, it's Sean's. The incident that Sean underwent was just one of those wrong place, wrong time moments. He's going to require lifelong medical and physical assistance. The target that we've set is an initial target of 2 million euros. So we know, we're realistic enough to know that that is the start of Sean's rehabilitation campaign. So we really would like that, if people could find it in their heart, to just keep him in their thoughts. His road to recovery is long. It's going to be difficult. But with the right support, we're hopeful that he can have a meaningful and a recovery.
And just give me that URL once again.
So it's gofundme.com/support Sean Cox. And our Twitter is at CoxyNWA, and our Facebook is Support Sean. Just one other thing, we do have a very large event coming up in next month on the 12th of April, when Liverpool FC Legends will take on a Mick McCarthy-managed Legends of Republic of Ireland team. Tickets will go on general release tomorrow, I believe, on Ticketmaster. They will be priced at €20 per adult and €10 per child, and I think there's a family special. So we're hoping to fill the Aviva on the 12th. And it should be a great night. Kenny Dalglish is coming over to manage Liverpool FC, and we're all looking forward to a tremendous event. And hopefully, like I say, people will continue to keep Sean in their thoughts and in their hearts. And if they have a few bob to spare, they could throw it into the GoFundMe.
That was the team behind GoFundMe speaking to me earlier this week. Coming up next, what's Uber's plan for bike sharing here in Ireland?
Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com. Now we're going to talk about bikes, and you may well wonder, what's that got to do with tech? And I'm wondering that too. But the person who's here to tell me is a reporter with Fora.ie, Jonathan Keane. Jonathan, welcome back to the programme.
Thanks for having me.
Why are we talking about this?
Well, there's been a lot of business around bike sharing apps, mm-hmm, and bike sharing networks and the whole kind of sharing economy generally. So bikes, companies like Uber, for example, have, you know, bought a company last year called Jump, which do electric bike sharing and scooter sharing. Scooters, obviously, are a big area as well. So you might necessarily think bikes and tech, but there's kind of an underlying tech as far as sharing bikes and renting out bikes, much like, you know, your Uber and Airbnb type models.
Yeah, it's interesting because this is a big market and it works really, really well in some cities. Like, we know that we have the Dublin bikes here in Dublin, believe it or not, and there's versions of it around the country. What did Uber want to do? Because again, many people would think Uber, the taxi app, not really used a whole host here in Ireland. So are we going to see Uber bikes around the place?
That's certainly their plan. They would like to do, as I mentioned earlier, they bought a firm last year called Jump for a reported $200 million. And they do electric bikes and electric scooters. That you kind of, you would rent out a bike or a scooter. It's stationless. You would just track it down on the app and you'd rent it out. So they wanted to do that here in Dublin. We presume it's with Jump. That's their division now for electric bikes and scooters. But in this case, it was just for bikes in Dublin. They went to Dublin City Council looking for like a license for some approval to at least roll it out in the city and see how it takes off. Dublin City Council said no to that. People in Dublin might be familiar with some of the other bike rental schemes that are in the city, like Bleeper Bike, which got its license last May. So Dublin City Council is kind of adopting a very cautious approach to bikes right now, and they said it wouldn't be appropriate, and that was their term, not appropriate at this time to grant a license to Uber.
I love that. It's such a generic line. It's not appropriate. And so what do we have any understanding as to the rationale of that? Because surely it's better if we're all on bikes, and it's better if we're, you know, freeing up the buses and freeing up the car lanes and so on. What makes it inappropriate to issue a license for something else that'll get us on bikes?
Well, they didn't go into too much detail on that, but one thing that was cited was the availability of parking spaces for bikes where you could chain them up or dock them for someone to take on. I go back to Bleeper Bike again. In their case, their license, it needs to be docked at like a bike stand. You can't just, you know, dump it on the street and let someone else pick it up then. So I guess parking infrastructure or bike rack infrastructure, I should say, is probably one maybe issue. Mm-hmm. And I think also the fact that it's less than a year since they gave the first licenses out. They're going to carry out a review in May. I think, as I said earlier, maybe taking a kind of a cautious approach rather than just giving out licenses to everyone.
It's interesting because we know that, like Owen Keegan, for example, is a big cycling advocate. He's all for it. And we know, again, like our office is close enough to Stephen's Green, and there's a section around the green that there's no bus lane anymore. It's just a big, huge cycle lane. So the city seems to be optimised for cyclists. So is it that they want to make sure that a business can make money? Like, I'm just struggling to understand. I know you're saying about the infrastructure, the bike rack infrastructure. Is there any other reason why, or is there any like business reason why they would be reluctant to share on or to give the green light to any licensing?
I think it's still a relatively new business in the grand scheme of things. I think maybe they just want to race in and Uber as well. I mean, it's maybe not so much skin off their nose. Not get Dublin because they're trying to roll this out across Europe. I mean, it's a Jump is in several cities around the US, so they're obviously planning the European expansion. So, you know, not launching here in Dublin is not going to inhibit them. And in the grand scheme of things, I'm sure they would still like it. But I mean, I think they are still kind of proving that business model as well.
And so, talk to me then. You mentioned Bleeper there. So I'm going to get probably a little bit of hate here now, but I'm not a cyclist. I'm terrified. I don't like the idea of cycling through Dublin. I can just about be on the Lewis in Dublin. How popular, what is Bleeper? Where do they come from? How popular are they?
From Dublin. Bleeper Bike, like I said, they got their license there last May. I think they have a couple hundred bikes now in their network around Dublin and I think in South Dublin as well. So you'll see the bikes around a lot. I certainly noticed a lot more in the last few months. I heard of the company, and then all of a sudden bikes started appearing and it seemed much more prominent. So they're obviously kind of racing into that, and taking advantage of the opportunity there. But yeah, I think there's a couple hundred bikes on the market. I think they're trying to prove again their business model in Dublin before going anywhere else.
And you mentioned earlier on just about the scooters, the electric scooters and so on. I'm starting to notice quite a few of them popping up, like individual people bringing these scooters into the city. Do we know much about the legality and the licensing? I watched a Casey Neistat video on YouTube about these scooters in New York and whether or not you have to have sort of a driver's permit to be able to go on one. Is it classified as a vehicle or is it, you know, a scooter? Like, what is, because there's a lot of kind of grey area, isn't there really?
Yeah, it's definitely still a grey area, especially here in Ireland as well. I believe it's not considered like a mechanically propelled vehicle because there's no seat on it. You're just standing on it going at a very kind of low speed. So that might be where kind of the lines blur a little bit about where it goes in. But then you ask questions about, I mean, should you do it on a footpath? Should it be on the bike lane? Should you be in like, you know, the actual road lane, which sounds scary to me.
Yeah, I would not do that.
So, yeah, I mean, I believe was it Noel Rock, TD, was trying to present some a bill there late last year to kind of firm up the rules around it. I'm not too sure how that's developing, but...
I actually think I saw a press pick of him on one.
Mm.
And Noel, if you're listening, I did laugh.
That sounds about right about Noel Rock, yeah.
Noel is one of my favourite. Like, he sends out, Noel is the TD who sends out amazing press releases. Anytime there's like a big gig in town, he'll send out like a pun-filled email press release about ticket touting, which is a serious issue, but he brings a bit of humour to it. So can we anticipate more of these types of startups and innovations coming in, particularly in relation to transporting around our cities? Because as you've just mentioned there, it's difficult to get licensing and to get the green light to go ahead. So is this market going to become swamped? Is it the new, you know, My Taxi versus everybody in terms of taxi apps?
I think there are two sides to it. I think there are certainly a lot of companies that are doing, a lot of very big companies. On the scooter side, you have, you know, big US companies like Lime and Bird. And then on the bike side, you have a big Chinese company called Ofo last year, but they almost went into bankruptcy because their business model almost fell apart in China.
Oh.
So there's, like, as I mentioned earlier, it's still kind of early days for the business model side of things. I think you're going to have a lot of companies come in, and then a lot of them are going to kind of flame out very fast. Because I think the days of, like, you know, the old Uber model back in the day of just, you know, launch your product and then ask for forgiveness from regulators later, that kind of, those kind of days are past now.
It's so bit them in the backside pretty, yeah, heftily, hasn't it really? Like, they're still kind of picking up the pieces from going in with that sort of slapdash model to begin with.
Yeah, I think a few years ago, if you had a bike sharing startup in Dublin, whoever they might be, they may have just, you know, put their bikes out in the street and just launch the product and let it go from there, and then maybe talk to the Dublin City Council afterwards.
Yeah,
that doesn't fly anymore. I think there's just a lot more scrutiny on this kind of, any kind of sharing models or sharing economy business models and startups. So, like I said, I think it's going to be kind of weeding out some companies along the way. I think there'll be some successful ones who will be here years to come. They'll play nice with regulators, but then others might just, you know, fall by the wayside.
As a business model, I mean, how much money do these types of companies make, even if it's just around the world, in cities around the world? Because, you know, with Dublin Bikes, isn't it a tenner a year, I think it is, and you can sort of use the bike and then you get a penalty if you have it for too long or if you don't drop it back properly and so on. Is that how it works?
It's sort of a similar business model, as far as I understand. I'm sure it differs from company to company as far as charges go or,
yeah,
penalties if you don't bring it back in time, or if you bring it outside of certain limits within the city. I think you have to stay within, you know, the reaches of, say, a city centre or a certain urban area. So I think different companies are going to try different things as far as enticing people to use their scooters or bikes. But as far as what business model will score out, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And especially, just again, I know we're only talking about Dublin specifically here, and there are ones around the country, but Dublin city centre has gone under such a huge transformation in the last 18 months with the Cross City Lewis and all that sort of stuff. It's like, I'd say if you want to get around at any decent speed, cycling is probably your best bet, like, because it's just a nightmare to navigate through at the moment, personally speaking.
Yeah, I mean, College Green was a construction site for a long time there. It was a nightmare to get through. And like, I mean, I'm, like, again, like yourself, I'm actually not a cyclist personally.
Mm.
So, I think it would be a good idea to make Dublin a better place to cycle in and make it safer to cycle in. I don't how that's going to happen, but I think if more people are cycling bikes, then that demand will be there.
The safety thing is interesting as well, because I'm always baffled that there's no helmets with the Dublin bikes.
You're not required to wear helmets?
Well, I don't know if you're required to, but you'd want to be carrying a helmet with you then at all times. Do you know?
Mm. Yeah, so that catches up maybe the people as far as, you know, kind of on a whim saying, oh, let's grab a bike to go to X. I suppose you're not going to have your helmet with you, especially if you're not a regular cyclist.
If you are a regular cyclist and you can inform me any better about that, email techtalk@newstalk.com. Also, would you like to see more of these services around the place? Or, you know, is it going to encourage idiots like me jumping on a bike who don't know the rules of the road when it comes to cycling? Let me know. As I said, the email address is techtalk@newstalk.com. Definitely a case of watch this space. For the moment, Jonathan Keane of Fora.ie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you'll find it up in full on newstalk.com, in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Patrick Egan is up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.